So,
so you know, something new becomes dead. Presumably, Mongravidi did murals for the post office in New York, and
something new.
Something new becomes the new academy. You know,
modified, concretized.
Universities. Yeah,
it's this not living anymore.
Yeah, right.
So
yeah.
Your job as an artist
is to shatter this.
Yes.
As you move along, to shatter
yes.
this. What's that like for me? I've really not. I love to do it, but I've really kind of surrendered. You know, here I am in Alaska. You know, I really have no options but to do it, but to see things in a different way.
What does that being in Alaska have to do with that, or what, how do you mean that?
That perhaps I should have stayed in New York.
In order to what?
In order to achieve recognition, fame, and lots of money, you see. But I don't equate these things with art, you know.
Yeah.
Like if you breathe, I paint the way people breathe, really. So what's all the fuss about? But,
there's something, though, about being validated, I think, by others. I mean, it's as though, to me, I don't know if you agree with this, but it's like the painting is a communication of something.
Yeah.
And it needs to be received, doesn't it, somehow? Understood, or...
Needs to be received and understood. And I'm reminded of when Patty took me to Poindexter Gallery. She knew nothing about it, didn't realize I was one of its stable of artists. And she started looking at the paintings. I said, you don't look at the paintings. You stand and look at the artist, because he is under attack. And there will be a fellow giving you something to drink, and you take a drink, and when the artist turns towards you, you raise your glasses, and he'll come to you, and he'll say, that son of a bitch with the times, I think it's unfair about number 13 over there, the bastard, you know, I said, why don't we have the right to refuse a reviewer who's going to do a number on us? And you agree with this, you see. So here he is, this sconce. We're talking about Jules Wolitski. He had won a Carnegie Award for $250,000. And here he's having a show. And but that means nothing. What means something is that people are still giving him shit.
You want to turn it off?
Here he is at the height of something and feeling very insecure,
yes,
I remind
so you. Him.
You see, so you support him no matter what.
You went to the show?
I went to that guy's show involuntarily. My wife dragged me there, not realizing that I was once associated with Poindexter Gallery. I remember nothing of that show. For that matter, Cy Twombly returned to America and put on a show, I forget where, I don't know what gallery, and he said, well, I have to admit it was a pile of shit, and I really deserved the reception that it drew, you see? So even when people hurl things at the canvas and so on and so forth, there is some sort of consciousness in all of this, you know. was in Paris. I had a lady who I was friendly with in New York.
Named what year, roughly?
I think this was 62.
This is just before you were married to Patty.
Yeah.
So you went to Paris with some friend, or?
I went there with Pierre Benerup, who I fought fires with up here.
How do you spell Benerup?
B-E-N-N-E-R-U-P. And anyway, I ran into Eva Weiler. I prefer that you don't use her name. We'll call her Eva. And she said, and I said, you know, I'd really like to meet Giacometti. And she knew him. She was Swiss, living in Paris. And he was Swiss, living in Paris. And then we had the mix-up with the coffee shops, you know, and this was intolerable to my waiter. But anyway, I got to see him, and here's this fellow playing with what appeared to be peanuts and putting them in the ashtray. Like an idiot, I should have picked these things up. But anyway, we finally toddled off to his studio, which I wanted to see. And it was on Montparnasse. You know, when you see paintings of Montparnasse, you see these corners of an avenue. You know, they are really corners. And we walked up this corner, and we were in this cobbled courtyard, and with stables. These were once stables, you see. And also there was a kind of a spring rain, fall, and sunshine, and the whole area was drenched in the fragrance of horse piss. Anyway, this guy is doing his work, and indeed living in a stable, you see. And we went into this, there was this stable door that, the top opens up to, so the horse could look around what the future holds in store for him. And we went into this dark place. It was only illumined by this half door. I couldn't see anything. And I kicked something that hurt my leg. And I was saying, God damn. I said, you're getting $1,000 for your fucking sculpture. Why do you live in a place like this? Why? You know, in heaven's name, why do you live in a place like this? And anyway, Giacometti, I could speak to Giacometti because he spoke Swiss, and it's like a patois of French and German. And I understand this, and I can speak to people.
How is it? You speak French?
Yiddish is Germanic, and I had a superficial understanding of French, of the essential words. So I could speak to him. What he spoke was kind of a patois. If you're in the French part of Switzerland, there's this French Germanic thing, and then to the south it's an Italo Swiss thing. It's strange. To me, it's just like a patois. And my shin somehow inadvertently kicked some steel rebar or piece of steel. And it's dark in this place, and then they said, above you is a light switch. Pull on the string and there'll be light in here, you see. And I'm thinking, you $150,000 son of a bitch, you're telling me to pull on a fucking light bulb, you know. And I did, and the place was illumined. And the light was above a bed. And on the bed was this glorious looking young lady, a beauty of the first magnitude. And she stretched and yawned. And this young person was the wife of Giacometti. And she said, well, I have to leave. going to the chateau. And she left, you know, and through the half door on the window, this red Ferrari went driving by, containing her. She drove off to the chateau. Meanwhile, we have a solitary lamp light, you see, like what you have in a prison cell. And they're explaining this mystery. And Giacometti said, in this place, said Giacometti, I lived at the chateau. I lived there for 2 years. Alors, but I couldn't do any work, nothing. But in this place, said Giacometti, and with his fingers, he said, there are little molecules of creativity. You know what I mean? And he would pluck at these little atoms of molecules of creativity, and I understood. Then I got used to the light, or the lack of light, and there were his paintings. People think of him as a sculptor, others think of him as a painter. I think of him as a painter, I think of him as a sculptor. I think of the drawings of Rodin, which was scooped up by Mr. Keck in New York because the nation of France just ignored them and trod all over them. His paintings were not preparatory to doing sculpture. They were not. They were something in themselves. There was another dimension to them. And he worked in this kind of darkness, like burnt umber, that, you know, umber was the major color, and gray was the color of his palette, you see. And this strange use of perspective lines, you know, the space could be called not plastic or poetic, but really architectural, you know. And then there was the sculpture itself, all in this dark, gloomy thing. And so I just loved it. I felt privileged, you know. I enjoyed everything, even my ship, which was palpitating with, you see. And of course, to turn on that light and see this 19-year-old young lady, you see.
19, she was a lot younger than you then.
Yeah, yeah. And then her going up on the cobblestones and driving off in this fire engine red Ferrari, you know. I thought, my God, you know, the artist's life is glorious, you see. If only I'd saved those things he threw in the ashtray at La Selecte or Rotonde, you know.
And you were going to come back here. I mean, somehow you had made some kind of connection here, apparently.
Yeah.
Even though you were once again exposed to the art world, the art life.
I liked it here. I like the fireweed, which I thought was an exotic plant.
But you see it in England.
I saw it in England, and it was described by British propaganda as seeds that escaped from the British Museum during a bombing attack. And you see, you know, and here I see it, you know, in full regalia. And I might very well be, my neurons might be responding to how my parents lived for a millennia in Russia, you know, this same sort of thing,
yeah.
You know. I recognize things from childhood like sorrel, which makes a wonderful soup, hot or cold, you know. When I came here, I felt secure. I felt that this wasn't a wilderness was like walking into a big house. It was almost like a French village in the old days. You felt secure, you see, and you were amongst madmen. You felt sane. You see.
It's hard. I said it wrong. You felt sane amongst madmen?
Yeah. And I feel sane up here.
You
know.
Mean that you felt like you had found a kindred spirit or not?
Yeah, I felt that I'm amongst kindred spirits.
Did you know Patty?
I met her mother before I met Patty. I met her mother 4 or 5 years before I met Patty. And I went prospecting in the 70-mile country. And we had deficient maps. And her mother was in charge of the USGS mapping in Fairbanks. And the maps were so screwed up that we decided to come back to Fairbanks. We were all bushier than hell. We all had Rocky Mountain fever from glacier water.
Beaver fever, or
Beaver fever, wherever the hell it was, you know. And we would hallucinate each in turn, and we all had guns. And finally, one guy would carry all the guns, and when he felt he was going crazy, and so this was sort of ghastly but very familiar to me. I thought, you know, I belong. Yeah, and then statements like, "That man can't do that. We'll place him. I shall place him under citizen's arrest." And I'm saying this with I'm in Alaska illegally, you know, and I'm going to place someone under citizen's arrest. It's hilarious, and you know, it was. Mad. We were on the 70 mile and sitting around a campfire, and we had about 5 miles to go to the Nick Arms, the falls, and we felt that the falls would yield a treasure load of gold. That we had studied the geology of the place at Claremont Men's College Library, and we felt that the river at 70 mile had a natural, what was like a natural riffle board. And all we had to do was use an underwater dredge and suck up all the gold and become millionaires overnight. Well, it didn't work out that way. But as we were preparing the evening meal, we had crossed the river, which was a monumental undertaking, because we had to reconstruct the trolley bridge that existed there and had been unattended for a quarter of a century. I could shove my finger into the logs on our side of the river.
What river?
The 70-mile river. And we had to replace all the logs on our side of the river. Then we drew lots for who was to cross the river, because the other side could very well break.
Hank, here, and I'm going to go down to Kelly.
Okay. Anyway, we finally crossed the river, having to construct a bridge, you know. Can you imagine doing anything like this in New York? No. Or in England, you know, this treasured land of where historicity is piled, you know, no way. And so we perform this monumental effort, and we're sitting around a campfire, and we're 5 miles away from our goal, and a dog comes running down the game trail next to the river. And we had this wild guy from Yugoslavia who was, we all met as firefighters, and this guy pulled up a rifle and was going to shoot this wolf. I said, "Put the gun down. Wolves don't wag their tails. This is an animal that belongs to someone." And the someone came down the trail. He was a cheerful young fella. And this guy said, "I'm going to kill him." I said, you're not going to kill anyone. This is America. We don't do that. We're going to sit him down. You put the fucking gun down. And we'll offer him coffee and something to eat, some beans. And he sat down. I forget his name, but he said that he had staked the falls, the Nick Arm Falls. But the postmaster flew over his site and informed him with a tin can and a message that he was drafted into the army to serve in a place called Korea. He was in the National Guard and a pilot.
Okay, wait a minute. Korea, by the time Europe got to Alaska, Korea was old and over with in terms of military intervention. I mean, a place called, we all knew Korea by then.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like
the... He had to go to Korea. There's
not to be drafted not, and go to Korea.
Yeah, not Vietnam.
Okay. It was too early for Vietnam and too late for the Korean War.
Yeah.
Okay.
And he had to go. And we sat down, and he said, I gotta go. And he said, I staked out the fall.
He staked
the claim where we had researched and were going to stake the claim. And he said that there's nothing I can do about it but go and serve my country. And you can work there. And if you give me a fifth and send it to my mother, I'd appreciate it very much. And we all agreed to this, except this Yugoslav from this Montenegrin guy who didn't accept this sort of thing, you know. So we all agreed to that, and he went down the trail. He had a canoe, and off he went, you see. So I remember that. Later on in this business, via the Yukon River, we went into the 70 mile with a boat that was rigged for underwater work. It had a suction dredge that was attached to the keel of the boat. We found that we didn't have the experience of lining a boat, you know, pulling a boat by ropes up the river. And we found that we had a 27-horsepower Evinrude that couldn't take us up the river. So we had to ditch and had to pull this thing up the river. During one episode, we lost the boat, all of our food. The only thing that survived was spaghetti in plastic, which could float. So we've salvaged all sorts of pasta, bow ties, and spaghetti, you see. And so we had to come back, two of us had to come back to Fairbanks to get food and also to have repairs to our dredge, which was damaged. Four of us had managed to line the boat 12 miles into the 70-mile river. But when we came back a week later, you know, this is so Alaskan and so unlike anything I've ever been involved with. When we came back a week later, we went to Eagle, which was our base town. We had a 20-mile walk to the 70-mile river, and we looked forward to floating down to where our friends were. And where we slept was in the old NC Company store, which I kind of remember as a magic place. There was an old a circus picture. There's a picture of Jenny Lind, the Swedish, who came here, cobwebs all over the place. And we lit a candle and we put it on this pole or post. And then one of the other partners had fled the Yugoslav, the giant Yugoslav, and there he was, illumined by the candlelight. Lindley Nixon. I said, my God, what are you doing here? And he said, Bronco went crazy and started flogging me.
And I,
Bronco Kabrick was one of the partners in this thing.
So you said Bronco started hitting him.
Yeah, Lindley Nixon said Bronco started whipping him. And I thought, my God, this is outrageous. You know, things like that, you know, thinking I'm back in England, you know. And I did that before in Houston, Texas. I said, my God, this is ridiculous that, you know, one can't get shot. You know, this is in a restaurant where they had a picture of a bobby on the wall and things from pictures from England and Tudor beings and stuff like that. My God, this can't happen here. I'll place him under citizen's arrest, said I. And
just for my edification, the guy, the Yugoslav, was the one who started hitting Lindley? Or
yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, I felt terrible about this, but then I learned that two men, whereas four men had lined the boat 11 miles, these two guys had lined it almost 24 miles.
Lined it?
Yeah.
What's
they
that mean?
Dragged it.
Oh.
Pulled it, you see. They figured it out. So they did all this work. And I thought, you know, well, my God, that's what it takes. Flogging. You know, Europeans understand flogging, particularly, you know, Yugoslavs, having been occupied by the Turks for 300 years, know a thing or two about moving forward, you know. And we convinced Lindley to return to the project. And this meant walking the trail to the 70-mile river, donning our skin suits, and jumping in the river, and in sunshine, sailing down it like happy beaver or happy animals, you know. And finally, Lindley said, this is where I left him. And I thought, this is where I'll arrest this man, you know, said I, the ship jumper. And we got up on this sandbar, and the sandbar turned in, was sort of a beach, and we saw poor Bronco. I say poor Bronco. And he was... he had a fire and he was sitting there all alone. And then when he saw us, he cantered towards us like a gorilla, his hands held low, you know, and we all kissed one another, you know. So the business of that confrontation of law and order just disappeared. And we all shook hands and went on down the river. And then we learned something about the 70-mile river that can rise 8 feet in 6 hours. And we lost a lot of equipment again. And we sheltered in a lagoon. And the water didn't lower or desist. There's no way we could reach the falls with our equipment. So we all did a very English thing. We all shook hands and said, let's go on back. And we did, you know.
You mean go home?
Go home, yeah. In Eagle, the boys, being the oldest, you're placed in command of personal things, you know. And we flogged, we pawned our... scuba suits with a guy who was sort of the unofficial mayor of Eagle, a fellow named I'll think of it. Damn, I can't think of his name. But we this is the fellow who had all sorts of different hats, and 1 minute he'd be the mayor. And when we said we need a pawnbroker, he said, I am the pawnbroker, you see. And we pawned all of our equipment, got a tank full of gas to head back to Fairbanks. And the boys started complaining, we need soda pop, stuff like that, things they crave, you know. Hi-ho, was candy, you know, those things, you know, the things you crave. And I thought, where am I going to get money to satisfy these bastards? I had enough money to buy a hamburger, which we'd split in four if we got to Big Delta, you see. But art was very far from my mind during all of this. I really enjoyed this immensely. And so I, when I came in from the bush, this man approached me and he said, "Alfred, is that you?" I said, "Yes, it's me." And he was the rector of the Episcopal Church in Eagle. He was an Episcopal missionary. And his name was Lord Crewe.
Lord
Crewe.
C-R-U-E?
C-R-E-W-E. Okay. Yeah. Lord Crewe. Lord Crewe, the Lord Crewes were like Colin Powell, head of the military staff during the Crimean War and stuff like that. And a very distinguished family in the military history of the British. And here he was the missionary. And we met at the, we actually met in London. There was a writer, a philosophical writer, the English version of Jean-Paul Sartre. Can't think of his name, I'll think of it. And that's where we met, but I don't remember him. But this was a fellow who was about 20 years old, that's all.
20 years of age?
20 years of age. So presumably when I met him, the British writer's name was Colin, something or another. I'll think of it. And I'm listening to this, and this guy seems like kind of an illusion. You know, here I am out of the bush, and this fellow says he knows me. And all of us have suffered from this fever, you know.
Giardia.
Yeah, I was relieved of all the guns, you see, because I was acting kind of strange. And what I said to Lord Crewe was, "Do you have a potato?" And he said, "No, I don't." I said, "You do have potatoes, don't you? I'm craving a potato." He said, "Oh, really, Alfred? If you want a potato, just come in the rectory. I've got lots of potatoes." So I got kind of ugly with him. I said, "You know, you son of a bitch, you have potatoes. Why don't you give me a potato?" Anyway, we wind up in the rectory, and under the kitchen sink he had potatoes. He said, "Here is a potato. How shall I cook it for you?" I said, "No, I just want to eat it. I'm eating these raw potatoes," which I've never done before in my life. Yeah. And I said, "You know, I helped him with a sermon." He said, "I'm not reaching these people," said he. He said, "Like, I said comic cuts. No one understands." I said, "They don't understand comic cuts. You must say the funnies. These are cartoons."
What word did you use? Comic cuts?
Cuts. British say comic cuts. We say cartoons.
C-O-M-I-C. Comic
cuts.
K-A-T-Z.
Comic cuts. C-U-T-S.
Comic cuts.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so I'm making little changes in his sermon. So anyway, I said, "You know, I'd really like to go into the church now and pray."
You said that?
I said that to Lord Crewe. And he says, "I understand." So I went to the church and I checked the offertory box immediately. And there was about $5 in there in change. And I took it all for my crew to buy soda pop and ho-hos. And I remember looking at the altar and saying, "I'm sorry about this. I'm a Jew. There's nothing you can do about this. But I'll repay you 50." And the church seemed to say, "You cheap son of a bitch." Jesus seemed to say, "How about 60? You know. And I said, "All right, I got $5, I'll repay you, that'll be what, $50. See, I leave the church, pursued by these illusions, went to what used to be I said, fellas, I got some money, you can buy whatever the hell you want. And they bought soda pop and stuff like that. And we got to Big Delta, and there was a restaurant there we called the Bay of Pigs, this is in the Bay Hotel. We called it the Bay of Pigs, I don't know why. And there was a waitress who kind of knew of us named Uta, a German gal. And I said, all we can afford is one hamburger, okay? And she understood, and she came back with a huge hamburger about this wide. And we all ate this one hamburger and got back to Fairbanks.
Okay, so you met Patty's mother.
When we got back to Fairbanks, I said, you know, the USGS, the citizens of Eagle placed bets that we wouldn't get out of there, that some of us wouldn't make it, and that we'd get lost. And when we were in Eagle, they took us to a community cabin, and on the end of it was a contour map, a three-dimensional map. And they said, when the prospectors came here at the turn of the century, one of them was a British ordnance officer. And they said, listen, some of us are going to make money, but most of us won't. But if you give us a map, you'll make lots of money. See, there's no law here. There's this guy, Judge Wickersham. But we need a map to settle arguments, and that's your job. So the Englishman made this splendiferous map. It was in this cabin and occupied the entire wall, end wall. And along the sides were benches where people could sit and where guys would confront one another and then look at the map. Years later, I went to Eagle, and this had disappeared. I said, where's the community cabin? They said, what community cabin? I said, where is the map? They said, there's no map. I said, how long have you been here? This is the curator of a new... She said, I've lived here for 16 years. I said, I was here almost 38 years ago. And I tell you, there was a community cabin with a map. Where is it? Someone in Fish and Wildlife had stolen the goddamn thing. There was also the Amundsen cabin. I made sketches of it. Did a painting of it at the museum. And then it disappeared. They had some splendiferous wood laminar. Anyway, in this situation was like Greenwich Village, you see. It was the same, it was a replication of that. And, you know, the anxiety and survival. I was very familiar with it. You know, people couldn't understand why I prospered. I came into town, and by this time I was in a hotshot crew of firefighters from Southern California. And I mentioned, you know, I said, Jesus, you know, I'm really worried by something. These boys go on the fires with fetishes and good luck charms and stuff like that, you know. Particularly if they're jumpers and they jump on a fire, you know, they have rabbit's foot and Christ knows what else. And I said, you know, I robbed this offertory box down in Eagle, you know, and I got to get back there with the money. And they said, what? Holy shit, you know, we're going to have, people will die because, I said, no, I said, it's what we're talking about is about $50, that's all. So the money, they raised the money. And I went back to Eagle and put the money in the offertory box. There was $20 in the offertory box. And I came back with $200 that was collected.
Oh, it was not five. It was
no, it wasn't five.
$10.
Yeah. When I went to the...
you can get more than one hamburger for $20.
You can't... We had to buy ho-hos. I remember that accursed candy. We had to, those little Swiss rolls.
Yeah.
And they wanted soda pop, things, and other rubbish like that. That we had money enough for one hamburger, you see. And gas, you know. You worry about gas.
Yeah.
So
you came back to Fairbanks and somehow you met Patty's mother.
Yeah. We intended, we had some guns. We had an old Krag, which is a Swedish gun, a bolt action rifle. We had a flat trajectory Winchester. We had handguns. And we decided that we'd drive by the USGS office, which is down on that street, Illinois. And we were going to shoot up that goddamn place. They gave us these phony maps. And we drove in there, and a pleasant lady came out. And we thought, oh, well, we'll come back when she's not there, you know. And we came back, and the pleasant lady came out again. And she was running it, and this was Patty's mother. And I said, I think she's employed by this office. So why don't we go in there and just, we can't shoot up the place. There are women in there, for Christ's sakes. So we went in there, and that's how I met Patty's mother. I said the maps were abominable. There was a map down there that we saw that was more detailed than this. There were creeks in that map that don't exist in your map. And she said, well, they're going
down where?
Down in the Eagle, in the community cabin, yeah. I said, and she said they were going to photograph the area and they'll be producing a new map. So that's how I met Patty's mother, about 4 years before I met her. When I was in Paris, the boys of the hotshot crew and the guys who were going to go prospecting called me and said, come on back, because there'll be muskrat fires and that'll help us. It'll be like, you know, staking us. We've got some easy fires. And but when I arrived in New York, I had about $4 or $5 from Paris. Came back. And I thought that in New York I knew people and that I could borrow money to go west. But everyone was out of New York with the season. They were either in Woodstock, Provincetown, or Long Island. And here I am on a telephone. Now, one fire the year before, a patrol came in and they said there are two guys living on the riverbank wrapped in newspapers and they said they want bread. And I said, Americans never want bread. They want cake or they want candy. These are foreigners or rich kids. And I said, we'll take bread, though, if that's what they want. So we went out there, and there were two guys. One was Ed Stanton, and the other one was Tommy Fetter. And I said, you got to get out of here, because we're going to backfire against the river. And they said, well, we're expecting the Utana barge lines, and we're waiting. I said, good, because you better not be here. They thanked me for the bread, and I thought, Jesus Christ, these must be rich kids. They're Americans.
You said Americans always want cake.
Cake or what have you.
These were rich kids.
And they also swore by newspapers. They wrapped themselves in newspapers, but the newspapers were the Herald Tribune and the New York Times. Well, these are rich kids. Anyway, well, I had a field jacket, and this guy put his card in there. Edward Stanton.
Edward what?
Edward Stanton. But he was a Quaker, and so was Theta. And he adopted the name of Siegfried Sassoon, which Quakers do. You know, someone who kind of embellishes their beliefs you know, in peace.
They had up a symbolic name?
Yeah, so his name was Siegfried Sassoon. So I remember, here I am in New York. I'm not making telephone contact with anybody. And I looked through my duffel bag, and here was this business card of Ed Stein. So I called Ed Stein. You know, any harbor in a storm. I had $4 or $5, that's all. He said, yes, I don't remember you. Oh, my God, the man who gave us bread. And he said, where are you? I said, I'm in New York. And he said, well, where, you know, and I told him I'm on the in the bus terminal on 42nd Street West. He said, well, you can get this bus that comes out here. It leaves every 45 minutes. And we'll wait for you at the bus stop.
Why were you wanting help at that point?
I had no money, and I wanted to get to California and rejoin these people.
Who you wanted to get to California. You were in New York.
I was in New York.
From where? From Paris?
From Paris, yeah. And got on the bus. I remember thinking twice about buying. I bought a hot dog, you know. And I thought, well, I got... And it was about $3 to go on the bus, you know. And I arrived in Stantonville. I didn't put together the fact that this guy's name was Ed Stanton, and this is Stantonville in upstate New York. And here were these two guys in a Jeep who I'd helped on the Yukon River. And they kind of gathered me up, and I thought, well, any harbor in a storm. And we drove into the hills.